The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Okay, so, I'm a member of the Workers Organizing Committee of Chicago. I work at Whole Foods, so if my boss is in the room, hello. What I'm going to try and do is sort of lay out who low-wage workers are, why the strategy we've been pursuing has met with some pretty good successes at the current moment, and kind of where do we need to go from here and what are some issues we've been running up against. So I think it's important to point out that low-wage workers are obviously mostly women and people of color, or disproportionately so. And I think this has specific ramifications in terms of how the work is raced and gendered. And it's also important to point out that it's also immigrant work and it's queer work. And while this diversity has really helped employers to keep wages low, I think it's also important to know that there's nothing inherently low wage about the jobs, and I'm going to come back to that a little bit later. So in terms of like who are the low-wage workers, there's another sort of set I want to point out, and that's the sort of the younger workers and the older workers. And when I say older and younger, I'm talking for young workers, I'm thinking about people under the age of 30. And for older workers, I'm talking about people who are either approaching what should be retirement age or have passed that. So for young workers, the future is incredibly bleak right now. And I include myself in this as sort of being college educated and not being able to find a decent job. Many of us came of working age either immediately before or soon after the 2008 financial crisis. And during the 5 years, we've been locked out in large part from living wage employment. And because most of us who are lucky enough to have jobs at all are forced into retail, food and service work, we also are unable to build the resume or skills that will ever allow us to find a better job. And then you add, of course, into this massive student debt, highly militarized schools, and a racist criminal justice system that leave way too many youths with criminal records that make them legal targets for discrimination, cuts to social programs, education, millions of families torn apart by deportation, and you have the makings of a massive social crisis, where literally an entire generation has really been left behind, received a drastic cut in living standards and life expectations. So now, older workers, on the other hand, who, like I said, are either approaching retiring age or have already passed it, have a different but similarly bleak situation. And so I think after a lifetime of work, often at the minimum wage, or sometimes below if they're undocumented, they're also watching the social programs that they have paid their entire lives into systemically gutted. So I think two militants that are in my union, and quickly I want to say is like it's not formally a union in the sense we have collective bargaining agreement, but we consider ourselves a union, and so I'm going to refer to it as a union, are longtime McDonald's employees. John works at the Navy Pier location here in Chicago. He's worked there for 27 years. Tyree has worked at another location for 21. And to last that long, you have to be a stellar employee because it means you never come in late, you never call off sick, you never make mistakes because all of those things get you fired. Both of these men are African American and neither of them make more than $9 an hour after a lifetime of work. So with no ability to save money because of poverty wages and social programs that are no longer guaranteed, these men and many others like them, men and women, are given zero respect for their decades of work, enriching McDonald's and other corporations. Instead, they're degraded at work and threatened for trying to organize. But I think critically that the neoliberal age of austerity is, it's not just a vicious attack, though it certainly is that. And especially since the end of 2010 with massive student protests in the UK and of course the kickoff of the Tunisian and Egyptian revolutions, Madison, Occupy, Energizing Struggle has put the idea of fighting back into our sort of popular vocabulary in a very concrete way. It's very widely recognizable. Even if our side doesn't necessarily yet have the organization to provide strategies that are capable of winning the things that we need to directly win. So nonetheless, when organizers began to approach workers, the concept of us and them, 99% versus 1%, is an idea that has mass traction in a way that it did not 5 years ago, and provides a critical foothold for early organizing, which is really the roughest part of going. And that's, of course, in conjunction with our horrible working conditions. And I know there are a lot of low-wage workers here in the room tonight, and I'm sure we'll hear about some of the horrible things we're subjected to. And it's really is the more you think about it, the worse it gets. So I think one of the really critical successes in this kind of organizing and the willingness of increasing numbers of workers to join in this kind of organizing in spite of the very real threats of retaliation and firing that exist really has its roots in this broad social radicalization. So I think it reaches across generations, but as I said, I think it's strongest in the under 30s and the people approaching retirement who faced really the bleakest of futures. I also think it makes sense from a broader labor perspective why the unions have decided that now is the time to make this campaign. Because it's not just that there's a massive unorganized workforce that desperately needs organizing, but in addition, any sort of policy gains made by Fight for 15 workers will affect already unionized low-wage workers as well, whether they're, you know, UFCW workers, SEIU workers under security and janitor contracts. And it's also a strategy with the aim to revive the labor movement as a whole. Though the top-down approach that has presented us with some contradictions and some limitations, which I hopefully will get to talk about a little bit. So all of this is to say is that, well, there's an element of spontaneity which has really characterized media coverage of these strikes. I think it's they're very much not spontaneous. And they're actually the product of a long, hard-fought workplace campaign of organizing that, while again has contradictions, is very much centered around a new layer of union militants who are going to form the next wave of the labor movement. So what does it actually look like to be a rank and file organizer in this movement, and to be specifically, in my case, a radical in this movement? Obviously, we work in very precarious situations. Many of us have multiple part-time jobs, which limits the amount of time we can devote to organizing. And while we're highly surveilled at work, basically like your boss is the NSA or something, and everyone but the worker seems to be okay with that in the name of productivity. Because the capitalists like it because it's workplace discipline, and the right of the boss to control your work has not been contested because we don't actually have power in the workplace. So I think this means that organizing, especially at first, required us to be extremely careful and surreptitious. Most organizing happened by like pulling a coworker aside at the end of a shift and doing one-on-one meetings, getting cards signed. While it seemed daunting, it was very doable when it was broken down into these very small steps. And as you continue to organize, traction was gained. It became easier and easier because other people began to talk to coworkers they knew would be interested, and it was easier to formulate a strategy on that basis. But at the end of the day, you also need extreme flexibility, because sometimes this means meeting at midnight when people get off shifts. It means hanging around for hours after work, waiting to catch people as they leave. And because our stores have very long hours of operation and are staggered along 15 to 20 minute intervals, this makes it very difficult to organize a mass meeting of people in the workplace, because there isn't really a shift change per se. Our union is also organized across shops and locations. So in the Chicago area, we're at over 100 stores with over 1,600 workers. The stores range in size. Mine is probably the biggest. It has 650 people in it, but they range to as small as 4. So obviously, this presents a real challenge in terms of like when we will be ready to take sort of the next steps and how we can operate cohesively as a union in a way that will not undermine the campaign in any one workplace. So once we've convinced a coworker to join, the next step is to get them to the central organizing meeting, which is where we actually work across all the shops in the city, sort of bring the most active members together, and we get a sense of the project as a city, and it allows us to actually build solidarity among ourselves. And I think one of the main reasons the most retail and fast food workers have not been organized is the difficulty presented by high rates of turnover. And so I want to talk about turnover for a second, because it is one of the central issues that we face at work. A lot of this turnover is due to very anti-worker policies, where you're just attacked for pretty much anything that you do that's wrong. This Labor Notes article that came out noted a Jimmy John's worker who was forced to take a picture of him saying, "I made 3 sandwiches wrong because he put the meats on in the incorrect order," you know, things like this. Or at like my workplace, we were told we were inviting sexual harassment by following the dress code. So this is aimed at disciplining the workplace, but it's also the case that low-wage work means that people are always looking for a way out because it's just not a sustainable way to live. Many of us rely on government assistance, food stamps, and this sort of thing. And sometimes people do find it. Sometimes, and this means a lot for people like working at a McDonald's, they may move up to a place like Whole Foods or Apple, still within the retail. Sometimes people go on to university. But these places still pay nothing like $15 an hour, and they do have slightly better working conditions, but as I think I've just described, they're still pretty horrific. More often, people are fired or simply quit because they can't tolerate the conditions anymore. But still, the overall rate of turnover has actually decreased since the crisis. And I think this generalization we need to draw out is that as the crisis has continued and work is being actually restructured as low-wage work, though even though I think it's important to point out it's not all retail and service work, it's also like onshoring jobs and decreased wage manufacturing. There's been a reduction in turnover because the jobs that were once considered good jobs no longer present a significant increase in pay from these low-wage work. The good jobs that did once exist and still to some extent do exist are inaccessible and are disappearing. And finally, higher education is no longer a bridge out of poverty for working class, but rather it's a guarantee you will remain poor. Because without assets, you will have this massive, crushing load of student debt. And so my final note on the question of turnover is to go back to the 2 longtime McDonald's employees I talked about, John and Tyree, who are both middle-aged African-American men. And this is to point out the racialized aspect of turnover, specifically with the ability to actually leave the industry and find other employment. Because for white workers, this has been really a question of downward social mobility. Whereas that has placed them in this trap that has been very carefully constructed for immigrants and workers of color for generations. So it's not as new of a concept to workers of color and to immigrants. So now I want to turn to where we are and where we need to go from here. So I think the low-wage struggles have taken place across very diverse locations and workplaces, perhaps in a more diverse way than this talk has probably implied, just because of the specificity of my own experience. It's hardly confined to just fast food and retail. They stretch across industry from warehouse workers for justice in Joliet, in California, to domestic worker organizing. And of course, we're strengthened by the beginnings of fightbacks in the already organized labor movement. I want to make one point for WOC specifically here in Chicago. WOC is Workers Organizing Committee of Chicago, because I don't think here we can overstate the importance of the Chicago teacher strike in really teaching us a lot about organizing and a lot about what it's going to take to actually win. So for anyone who wasn't in the city during the strike, the entire city was transformed. And in the period leading up to the strike, all of my coworkers were talking about it. Everyone wanted to support the teachers, and at my store, we actually have a displaced teacher who works there. So she started wearing her union shirt to work every day, and soon a few of us were wearing red shirts to work. And finally, somebody's like, well, we should wear buttons to support the teachers. And so we made a bunch of buttons off of the Whole Foods ones. We put like white out on them and we wrote, I stand with Chicago Teachers Union. And so then the boss came up to us. There were 3 of us wearing them the first day. And they said, you can't wear that. It's against dress code. You're only supposed to wear Whole Foods buttons. We're like, well, technically, one, it is a Whole Foods button. We just altered it a little bit. But then we said, you know, we won't take them off. You are welcome to pull them off of a student, but we're not taking them off. And they backed down because I don't think they really realized what they were in for. But then as soon as people realized that we weren't actually getting in trouble for wearing it, everyone started wearing them. And by the end of the week, almost, I would say at least half of my front end was wearing the buttons. Nice. And they, I think it's like what Glenn Greenwald said last night, where courage is contagious, right? And so once a few of us had done it, everyone did it. And soon I found out that even among people who had not been previously organizing, there was someone in the back had started a petition to donate our food that we normally throw away but is perfectly edible to the striking teachers. Management turned that one down, because they do. And one of the maintenance workers set up a strike fund donation bin in the break room, and we collected over $100. So I think in an extremely concrete way, the CTU taught us how transformative solidarity can actually be in changing the way people perceive their own power at work. So I think this lesson shows that the rank and file attitude of our union, where people, it shows now in like how things actually function now, where when we need to have solidarity actions, for example, a worker at McDonald's was being discriminated against for being sick. So they asked, is there anyone who would like to go back to form a small committee and then to walk her back to work? And they had like 20 volunteers. When they asked who will go to Milwaukee or to St. Louis to support workers walking out there, they actually were like, let's go on strike again to go and support the workers. And they had to be like, no, you can't go on strike for everything, but I think we should push back against that idea. So now we've had all of these walkouts around the country. But the question now really presents itself of how does this actually move forward? Because we, even though we've walked off and we have made real gains in some workplaces where like subway workers have sit in to get their paychecks, we actually got management to concede on an absentee policy. We've had a massive campaign around racism and sexism at Jason's Deli. So like, what is the next step to actually get to the making the $15 an hour? Because that is something that is really desperately needed, and I think it is achievable. But we need to really start to have a discussion about what is it actually going to take to get there, because obviously it has to be more dynamic than just doing the same thing over and over again. And I'm not necessarily posing full answer to the question. I think there are a lot of people here. We should debate it. And I think the last question I would like us all to consider, and I know Sarah will take this up too, is that what our struggle means beyond this immediate fight. What does it actually mean for the future of the labor movement? Because I think what is very important is that even though this movement has contradictions, it is also training a mass, a growing mass of rank and file leaders in their workplaces who, we don't have a long history of union militancy in our workplaces. We live, you know, most of us, especially in my workplace, where most of us are like under 30, so we haven't lived in a time with a fighting labor movement. So we are really having to relearn these lessons, but we are relearning them, and we're learning them in a way that we will take beyond this campaign to whatever we do. So we have this new group of workers who has been permanently transformed by their participation in this fight. And I think that that actually has a lot of potential going forward in terms of how do we rebuild a fighting labor movement in the U.S. Thanks.
I'm not as cool as Trish. I'm just a journalist. Sorry, guys. I haven't been on strike. I'm depressed. I've only had one union job, and it was when I was a grad student, and still I'm a labor journalist. I don't know. I just found out 2 weeks ago that my uncle was a Teamster. My family didn't even tell me this. I had no idea. I've been writing about labor for 3 years now, and I didn't even know this. Anyway, so I want to start out with an article that was in Bloomberg Business Week recently, the title of which was The Capitalist Case for a $15 Minimum Wage. This was by a venture capitalist named Nick Hanauer. I'm probably mispronouncing his last name. Felix Salmon, Reuters finance blogger, took up the case shortly afterwards and agreed that we need a $15 minimum wage. Dylan Matthews at Wonk Blog predictably dismissed it because, well, he's Dylan Matthews. None of them brought up the fact that this $15 an hour, this very specific number, had originated with a workers' movement.
Yeah.
Nobody brings that up. And yet, that is what happens when you have this demand, when this demand is circulating, when there are workers in seven cities making this specific demand. It gets into the heads of even the capital, the self-identified capitalists. So I want to take us back a little bit, because I'm from New York. I've been covering the labor movement in New York for 4 years now, since I've been living there. And so the low-wage worker movement in New York has been pretty exciting for a few years now. There's been a few movements that have been have made less fewer headlines, been slightly less dramatic, but have had really impressive gains. Specifically, I'm talking about among immigrant workers in car washes and in independent grocery stores. The grocery store campaign is one I find really, really interesting because we're dealing with largely, the employees are workers from Central Latin America, and most of the employers are themselves immigrants. And yet we see a lot of really interesting, well, racism, but, you know. And these are campaigns that have been led by community groups, New York Communities for Change and Make the Road New York, in partnership with labor unions. This is the model that we've now seen moving into this, the Fight for 15, which is basically, again, started in New York, started with organizing around housing issues. New York Communities for Change organizers were talking to people in fast food restaurants about their housing issues, and turns out it's really hard to find affordable housing in New York City when you make $7.25 an hour and work 20 hours a week. Weird how that works. The most expensive city in the country. And so they partnered with SEIU to start this campaign of organizing the fast food workers. The first strike went off last fall. It was pretty exciting to be there. The campaign was in the works for 6 to 8 months, I believe, before they pulled off strikes, just to underline Trisha's point about the fact that these are portrayed as very spontaneous events, that they're actually building on months and months of very hard work in the workplace, organizing. The next strike in New York was this spring, followed very quickly, in that case, by Chicago, Detroit, Milwaukee, St. Louis, Seattle, and Washington, D.C. In each of these, we see slightly different tactics. We see slightly different targets. So we've seen in New York, it's mostly fast food restaurants. Here in Chicago, I would love to ask Trish to talk a little bit more about the getting Whole Foods involved in this campaign, because I know that was an interesting thing. There are some retail outlets involved in some of the other cities. The one thing that most of these jobs all have in common, of course, is that they pay very little money. Most of them are minimum wage or just over minimum wage jobs. The Fight for 15 movement is, in all of these places, it's being led, I don't think this is a secret to anybody, it's being supported by SEIU. But it also is coming out of largely work that was started in any of these places by these community groups that are then partnering with the major union. And that's really impacting how the organizing is being done. So I don't have to tell anybody from Chicago what it's like to have a labor movement that actually has the community organized and involved, right? You guys have all seen that. We've been sort of jealous of it in other places. But in New York, it's a similar process. So the first strike went off in November, and one worker was fired the next day when she walked back into her job at Wendy's. And within about an hour, they had 100 people occupying the Wendy's, including members of the city council. My favorite story thus far is that as they had called people to come out, that one of the organizers was standing on the sidewalk, and city council member Jumaane Williams comes pulling up in his car, jumps out of his car, throws his keys at this organizer, and goes running inside to yell at the manager. The worker got her job back. This has been one of the things that these one-day strikes do as a tactic, if I can sort of detour for a second, is that they don't shut down production, they don't cause any real significant loss of income for the stores. What they do is that they're a demonstration of power. They're a demonstration that you can walk out and that you can come walk in back in the next day with your city council member and your organizer, and they're gonna stare your boss down and they're gonna say, if you retaliate against this worker, we'll be back. And they'll show you. And they walk back in with a video camera too, so those are fun. So this movement, the specific Fight for 15 movement, came about at the same time, very shortly after the first Walmart strikes. Again, this was in motion before the first Walmart strikes went off, but we're seeing similar tactics. similar low-wage jobs. The interesting thing, I think, about that is that the Walmart has been labor's white whale for decades, right? We've seen more traditional organizing campaigns fail or Walmart actually close a store in response to one successful union campaign. Whereas fast food has largely been ignored. It's been written off as a place where workers are young and they turn over very quickly and it's just kids and that doesn't actually matter. The average fast food worker is 28 years old. The average woman who works in fast food, which is 2/3 of the industry, is 32. They're not kids, they're not turning over fast, and as Trish said, the turnover has gone down even more so since the economic crisis because you can't quit as easily and go find another job when there are fewer jobs to begin with. So the last couple weeks for the Walmart movement have been pretty interesting. Some good, some bad. We've seen the first prolonged strikes. People who were on strike went to the shareholder meeting, shareholder frightening celebration that involved like Hugh Jackman. I'm really disappointed. I'm not going to go see the Wolverine movie now. had Walmart workers speaking on the floor. But we've also seen firings of striking Walmart workers in the last week. And that's going to be a really important point for the campaign as to what can they do to get those people their jobs back. So I've talked a little bit about tactics. I've talked a little bit about what these campaigns have in common. One of the things that I'm really sort of tired of having conversations about the future of the labor movement because they're usually asking people like me to predict it, and that's annoying because I'm not the future of the labor movement, really. I'm the future of people who are going to write about the future of the labor movement. I hope to keep writing about it for a while, but I think the future of the labor movement is something that's we're going to learn by doing it, that we're going to learn by experimenting. And that these campaigns, there are many of them, that low-wage worker organizing, as Trish said, is not just it's not just in the service industry, it's not just in retail, it is home care. That's going to be one of the fastest growing jobs in the country in the next few years as the baby boomers reach retirement age, as we need more and more care. And it's domestic workers, it's, as Trish also said, it's manufacturing workers who are being now pushed down to expected to work for $10 an hour with no union protections in right-to-work states. Increasingly, all of the jobs are going to look like Walmart jobs. You might not be doing the same thing, but the structure of your job is going to be very similar to that. They're going to be more and more part-time jobs, especially as people are now trying to make excuses to get in under having to provide health insurance for their workers. And this is, the structure of these jobs is something we've got to consider. We have a social safety net in this country that was built based on the idea that you would have a man who worked a 40-hour-a-week job that had a decent wage and could support his family, and there was a woman at home. And that's not true. For a large amount of people, it was never true. But for fewer and fewer people, it is true today. And we have to actually take all that into consideration when we think about how to organize these jobs. Part-time work has always been gendered. It has been perceived to be a woman's job, that women didn't need a full-time family-sustaining wage because you would have the aforementioned husband who was working full-time. So as we think about how to organize in these workplaces, we need to think about the specific conditions that the people who are working in them have been living under, are expected to live under, how that has, again, never really fit most of our lives in the first place, but it certainly doesn't now. And these part-time jobs are not being designed, no matter what they like to tell you about workers wanting flexibility, they're not designed around our lives. They're designed around the boss's life and the boss wanting to keep you unstable. One of my favorite stories, or at least favorite stories, from a Walmart worker was that her schedule was made by computer based on the year's sales the year before for that day. So if Walmart had a slow day, never mind that it might have been, you know, torrentially raining or something, that their schedule would be shaped that week. The amount of hours they get, which means the amount of money they take home to pay the rent, is shaped by what they sold last year. So I just want to there's a few questions, there's a lot of questions that are brought up by this organizing that I want to sort of throw out to the crowd, because I know I have a lot of people who have worked, who are working or have worked some of these jobs now, who have been involved in this organizing, and I want to hear from all of you. One of the big questions of this labor movement, of any labor movement, of any organizing, is, are the workers actually in control? Who is actually leading this? Is this actually a grassroots movement? We see the larger, you know, headline-grabbing campaigns. We also see in New York, I've been reporting a little bit on the work of the Laundry Workers Center, which is an all-volunteer worker center that's also working with low-wage retail and restaurant workers. And they've won some actually really impressive victories. I don't know if anybody in here has heard of the Hot and Crusty fight. And they won an independent union, and they won a hiring hall. Like, who has hiring halls these days? It was amazing. That this combination of community organizing and community group, existing community groups that have an existing base in the community and big established labor unions that have funding and that have trained labor organizers, that this should bring us the best of both worlds. Is it bringing us the best of both worlds? How can we make sure that it actually does and not bring us, in some cases, the worst of both worlds? And as Trish said, what's the end game? Is it a $15 an hour minimum wage, as the capitalists would say, or a couple of them would say? Is it a union contract at one store that then leads to union contracts at more stores? Is it the beginning of an entirely different way that we think about labor organizing? The question that I always have to ask when I'm talking about labor, when I'm talking about organizing, is what is this actually doing to build power for the people who are involved? And that's what I'll still be watching, and I would love to hear some thoughts from everybody out here on this. Great.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.